from Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Pentagon says Iran has carried out airstrikes in Iraq. Concern for Syrian refugees living in a Turkish landmine zone.
This is not a no man's land. This is a part of land that is owned by the Turkish authorities that they're responsible for in terms of the clearance of the mines that are there.
Today marks the 30th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. And a Christian group is to erect a giant Christmas tree near the Korean border. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The U.S. military says Iranian fighter jets have carried out airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Iraq. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says the U.S. believes the strikes are Iran's first against the militants who captured large areas of northern and western Iraq earlier this year. Some Iranian forces were already involved in fighting on the ground in Iraq. Kirby said the U.S. is not coordinating with Iran and that it is up to Iraq to make sure there are not conflicts in its airspace. The U.S. has been leading a coalition carrying out airstrikes against Islamic State fighters in Iraq since August. Both the U.S. and Iran have said that Iran will not be a part of that group. Meanwhile, Iraq's Interior Ministry said today that a woman detained in Lebanon is not the wife of Islamic State group leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Lebanese officials had said Tuesday that Lebanon's military had detained a wife and child of Baghdadi near the border with Syria. Landmines placed decades ago by the Turkish military today are posing a serious threat to Syrian refugees fleeing the conflict in their nation, according to Human Rights Watch. We asked Mary Wareham, advocacy director of the HRW Arms Division, about the situation.
This border has got an extensive minefield that runs almost along the entirety of the southern part of Turkey with Syria. The area of the border that we've been looking at Human Rights Watch is directly north of Kobani, which is the town, the border town in Syria that has seen the Islamic State advance. And as the Islamic State forces advanced, the civilians fled and they crossed the border, but many of them didn't use the border crossing point and instead just walked straight across the minefield. And many of them have brought their vehicles, their livestock with them. And because that is not allowed across the border into Turkey, their belongings, several thousand of them have remained there in the minefields. And we're concerned for their safety of those civilians who remain in that minefield, as well as for the victims that have already occurred in that minefield. And we'd like to see them leave the minefield as quickly as possible.
What should Turkey do about all this?
Turkey was supposed to have cleared these minefields under the mine ban treaty, and it has made some efforts, but it has not met its deadline to conduct that clearance, which was this year, and instead it requested an extension. So it's got now until March of 2022 to clear these minefields. The Kobani minefields are not the only part of Turkey which is mined. The country has got multiple mines around the perimeters of its borders, And we'd like to see it put more effort into clearing those mined areas. We understand the border with Kobani is with Syria is an active state of conflict right now, but this is not a no man's land. This is a part of land that is owned by the Turkish authorities and that they're responsible for in terms of the clearance of the mines that are there.
Now, your report says there's about 2,000 Syrian refugees remaining in the minefield. Should an international effort be undertaken to try to relocate these people? It's a lot of people to move.
It is a lot of people to move, and they need to move out of the minefield as quickly as possible. And we're urging that Syria provide safe passage to them. The problem has been that they came with their vehicles and their livestock, and those are not allowed across the border. But they cannot remain inside a minefield. There have been numerous casualties inside this minefield, including children, as well as the livestock. The refugees themselves have cleared at least six mines that they have found inside the minefield and handed them across. But this is not a safe place for anyone to be, so they need to leave, and it would be good if Turkey could help facilitate that process and do so as quickly as possible.
Now, you have some other major news today about landmines.
The Landmine Monitor 2014 report has been issued by the International Campaign to Ban Landmines today. This is an annual monitoring initiative that we've been doing for the past 17 years overall, it shows significant progress in addressing the landmine threat worldwide. The situation in Turkey involves old minefields. There are still old minefields around the world that claim victims every day. But overall, we're making significant progress now in the international fight against anti-personnel mines.
But significant progress doesn't mean the problem's gone. We still need to get this cleaned up.
Exactly. If we're to ensure that civilians are protected, every last landmine has to be cleared and no more mines can be laid. And that's what we are seeing in the landmine monitor findings, but we're still disturbed when we see new victims, especially when it's from old landmines that should have been cleared.
Mary Wareham, Advocacy Director of the Arms Division of Human Rights Watch in Washington. The World Health Organization reports the spread of Ebola is having a damaging impact on the delivery of health services for people suffering from other illnesses in the three severely affected Ebola countries in West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports one of the root causes of the rapid spread of Ebola in West Africa is linked to the weakness in the health systems of the three heavily infected countries. Ebola has killed around 6,000 people, but WHO Coordinator of Health Systems, Gerard Schmitz, says the deaths of many more people suffering from malaria, chronic diseases, and other illnesses probably can be linked to Ebola. He says Ebola has damaged the delivery of general services in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. For example, he notes, health workers who are caring for Ebola patients are no longer available to work in ordinary health care centers, disrupting important services such as vaccination programs.
For example, pregnant women don't have access to the care they need. Pregnant women don't have access to health centers simply because the health centers are closed because we don't have staff in these health centers anymore. In Guinea, for example, the general consultations and the hospitalization rates have dropped by 50%.
Dr. Schmitz notes health systems in the three countries were very weak well before Ebola struck. For example, in pre-Ebola days, Sierra Leone had 0.2 doctors per 10,000 inhabitants, compared to 2.5 in the rest of Africa and 14 doctors per 10,000 inhabitants in the rest of the world. He says the impact of the epidemic on already shaky health systems is huge and must be urgently addressed.
So we need clearly to focus on Ebola response. We need clearly to focus on rebuilding the general services, but we need also to focus on making the system resilient, to making the system stronger to resist to future epidemics or any disasters in the future.
The World Health Organization is organizing a meeting next week in Geneva focused on building resilient health systems in Ebola-affected countries. Major financial institutions, including the World Bank and the African Development Bank, will participate, as will ministers of health and finance from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Important technical agencies and non-governmental organizations operating in the region also will contribute to creating an action plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today marks the 30th anniversary of the deadly gas leak disaster in the central Indian city of Bhopal, known as the world's worst industrial accident in which thousands were killed or maimed. On December 3, 1984, a pesticide plant operated by the U.S. firm Union Carbide leaked about 40 tons of deadly methyl isocyanate gas into the air. Dow Chemical, which bought Union Carbide years after the accident, paid India $470 million in compensation for Bhopal gas victims, an amount activist groups say is not enough. They also demand greater access to health care for survivors and job opportunities. The New Delhi-based Center for Science and Environment has warned industrial gas leaks persist across the country due in part to lax enforcement of hazardous waste management laws. Last week, a chlorine gas leak from a factory near Bhopal reportedly sickened dozens of people. Raghbendra Jha directs the Australian South Asia Research Center at Australian National University. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie about the Bhopal disaster.
I was in Delhi on the 3rd of December 1984, night of 2nd and 3rd December when this occurred, and I viewed the outcry at that time, and the legacy that tragedy has left behind cannot be washed away so easily. It will take a lot of time because there are still festering wounds, direct wounds. Not everybody who was affected by that tragedy has been adequately taken care of. The public health response has been inadequate. The compensation has been inadequate. These protests will occur every time this date rolls around.
The BBC ran an article in which it said 30 years later, many still bear the scars, including children with birth and congenital defects and others whose lives have been blighted by chronic illness. Could you give us a sense as to the scars that are still left among Indian society?
There are many, many things to think about. First of all, there is the direct cost. One of the effects of this poisonous gas was to render many people blind. It blinded many people. Many people, people in the working age, they lost their livelihoods, and of course they have not been adequately compensated, so they still suffer because of that. And then there are these birth defects have been passed on from generation to generation, and there seems to be no end in sight. So the scale of the problem is still quite large. Of course, it is not anywhere as terrible as it was on that day 30 years ago. It's still quite large, and it is really a matter of great concern that it has not been resolved, even after the passage of such a long period of time.
Is the focus of the blame on Union Carbide, now owned by Dow Chemical, the U.S. company, or is it the Indian government and its response?
Well, I think that in the Indian mind, the difference between Union Carbide and Dow Chemicals is a little blurred. They don't see that difference as being very significant. They would blame Dow Chemicals as much as they blamed Union Carbide at that time. And so far as the Indian response has been concerned, various things have happened. As you know, the chief perpetrators were never tried, and alleged perpetrators were tried. And one of them, at least one of them, cannot be tried. And the Indian public health response has been inadequate. The government has not devoted enough resources and sympathy towards these people. So, yes, the people are resentful, both of the multinational corporation as well as the local government, both state and central.
What do you hope will be done to perhaps allow the country, the society, to move on?
Yeah, it's very important to move on. One cannot live with problems of, that antiquity forever. I think that there has to be an emergent plan to rehabilitate these people and give them proper employment, proper medical care, and proper compensation for what they have suffered. And move them away from that plant because the area around that plant is still quite toxic. And then only I think that we can possibly think of finally closing the chapter on this and moving ahead. I mean, Dow Chemicals can certainly do business in India, but I think and be welcomed by the Indian people, not just the Indian government. But I think some of these issues need to be sorted out before, we can begin with a clean slate.
Jha says the Bhopal leak was a result of both a lack of safety controls and human error. He believes the Indian government has woken up to the fact that, despite India's population density, such plants must be moved away from urban areas and allowed to operate based on strict environmental regulations.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The FBI has joined an investigation into a cyber attack on U.S. film studio Sony Pictures Entertainment. The November 24th attack comes just weeks before Sony is set to release a comedy about an assassination plot against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So the question on many people's minds, could North Korea be behind the hacking? VOA's Alex Villarreal has the story.
undisguised terrorism. That's what North Korean officials have labeled Sony Pictures' upcoming movie, The Interview. Stars Seth Rogen and James Franco play journalists recruited by the CIA to kill North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
So after Sony got hacked last week, news the company is looking into possible North Korean involvement did not come as a surprise. North Korea already complained to the United Nations and the White House about the movie, but would it wage cyber war over it? Frank Salufo heads the Homeland Security Policy Institute at the George Washington University, and he says yes.
They certainly have both the motive and the capability. They made their intentions loud and clear when the foreign ministry threatened that they will mercilessly destroy anyone who dares to hurt the supreme leader. And they also have the capability, since they've been investing very heavily in asymmetric means of warfare and technologies generally, and computer network attack and cyber capabilities specifically.
Salufo tells VOA that North Korea is likely investing a higher percentage of its money in building up its cyber attack capabilities than any other country.
What we lack at this stage is foolproof attribution. In other words, we don't have a smoking keyboard that they, in fact, were behind it, or whether or not proxies or those sympathetic to North Korea's causes were behind it, or if someone else altogether is behind it.
But even the North Korean government itself is not denying links to the hacking. Asked if Pyongyang was involved, a spokesman for the government said, "Wait and see." The hacking paralyzed Sony's corporate email, knocking it and other internal systems completely offline. Sony has since restored some of the affected systems, tapping cybersecurity forensics experts to repair the damage. But some of the damage could be harder to undo. Unreleased copies of five Sony movies, including an Annie remake, were leaked online after the hack, and there are reports the hackers stole personal data, including medical and salary information, of up to tens of thousands of employees. Salufo says the potential for North Korean cyber attacks is only set to increase. Unlike Russia and China, the two countries he says pose the biggest threat when it comes to cyber war, North Korea does not have as much to lose. Alex Villarreal, VOA News, Washington.
In South Korea, a conservative Christian organization received permission from the Defense Ministry to construct a new Christmas tree-shaped tower near the North Korean border. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul on the effort to build an overtly religious structure near the world's most heavily militarized border at a time of high tensions with the atheist North.
The Christian Council of Korea is planning to erect a 9-meter-tall Christmas tree tower on a high peak 3 kilometers from the border near a North Korean town. The tree is to be topped with a giant cross and illuminated with decorative lights during the Christmas season from December 23rd until January 6th. On Tuesday, South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-sok announced that the project will proceed.
그래서 국방부는 평화를 기원하는 점등 행사를 하는 취지와
He says the Ministry of Defense has approved the request considering the purpose of the lighting ceremony and to guarantee religious activities. This is actually a replacement tower for an aging similar structure that was dismantled in October because of safety concerns. North Korea had complained that the older structure was an act of propaganda warfare and warned against any attempt to rebuild the tower. The Christian Council of Korea declined to talk to VOA about this matter, but Kim Song-un, a Christian minister with Caleb Mission, says the group is merely practicing freedom of religion.
마치 우리 한국
He says some politicians and people say that this activity stimulates North Korea and creates tension, but he would ask the question the other way. He adds, South Korea must be a country that guarantees freedom of religion, as the Ministry of Defense has said, and North Korea also needs to accept this. Religious activities in North Korea are restricted to officially recognized groups linked to the government. Authorities there have jailed missionaries for trying to proselytize. In South Korea, surveys indicate about 29% of the population identifies as Christian, 23% as Buddhist, and 46% report no religious affiliation at all. South Korea has cited freedom of speech and religion to justify allowing activists to send balloons carrying religious and political messages into the north. A recent launch provoked a military exchange of gunfire at the border and angered North Korean leaders to the point where they canceled high-level talks aimed at easing military tensions. Daniel Pinkston, a Northeast Asia analyst with the International Crisis Group, is concerned that at the very least, South Korea's support for this Christmas tree near the border will make it more difficult to persuade the North to enter into talks about ending its nuclear program and improving its human rights situation.
If you're looking for some cooperative progress and looking for ways to cooperate with North Korea on other issues, this just gives them a reason to be uncooperative. So you don't get better off by this. I don't see how you get better off necessarily.
Since the Korean War ended in 1953 with an armistice and not a peace treaty, the border area known as the Demilitarized Zone has been guarded on both sides by thousands of soldiers, tanks, artillery, and landmines. And in the past, small provocations have led to limited clashes and casualties on both sides. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 3, 1967, surgeon Christian Barnard performed the first human heart transplant at a hospital in Cape Town, South Africa. On this day in 1984, in Bhopal, India, the leak of a highly toxic pesticide caused one of the worst industrial disasters in history. On this day in 1895, Anna Freud, the Austrian-born psychologist who pioneered the field of child psychoanalysis, was born. On this day in 1965, the British rock group The Beatles released their sixth album, Rubber Soul. That album is regarded as one of the greatest in pop music history. In 2012, at least 475 people were killed after Typhoon Bopha made landfall in the Philippines. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the brutality and the increasingly frequent attacks on the civilian population of Beni Territory, North Kivu, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. Machete and gun-wielding attackers have targeted several villages in the region, leaving almost 200 dead in the last 45 days. The illegal Ugandan armed group, the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, and possible others allegedly perpetrated these attacks, which included reported beheadings, mutilations, and rape. The ADF is a rebel group founded by a Ugandan radical Islamist sect in the 1990s. The attacks appeared to target civilians the rebels suspect are providing information about rebel movements to government and United Nations troops. The attacks are the latest in a series of massacres in the region. These atrocities should not go unpunished. The United States calls on the government of the DRC to initiate a prompt, thorough investigation and hold all responsible to account. The United States supports urgent, intensified efforts by the armed forces of the DRC with United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the DRC support to protect civilian populations and to eradicate all illegal armed groups in eastern Congo. This includes the ADF and the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. The United States will continue to support the government and the people of the DRC, as well as the United Nations, in their combined efforts to consolidate peace, security, and stability throughout the country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com.